want to lay out some background, and then I'd like us to talk about it, and that we can share experience and our thoughts on this matter. The cost of higher education has become a national issue. How many of you saw the Time magazine front page that said how colleges are gouging you? Yeah. There are articles in the paper. There's now hearings in the House about the cost of education. And in general, it's become, as Clinton says, it's his number one issue, education. It has become, you always like to get attention, but now you have to be careful. Sometimes your wishes are satisfied. I don't know how many of you saw the New Yorker cartoon that shows the man looking up at the judge. The judge is in his box, and the man said, "The tuition payments made me do it." There's no doubt that there's a considerable anxiety in the United States about the high cost of education. But first off, I want to talk a little bit about what's driving costs. But the first thing I need to point out is that education for most Americans is not that expensive, actually. Education is something that can range in cost from, say, $1,200 at a two-year junior college that's state-supported to one of the Ivy League schools or the University of Pennsylvania, which was featured in that article in Time, that has tuition alone well over $20,000, and when you add room and board and books, you're over $30,000. So that's quite a range between institutions that would charge $1,000, $1,200, or $2,000 for a year versus an institution that could be well over $30,000. St. Olaf College, where I'm president, charges the total, that would be tuition, room, and board, for a full pay student is about a little over $20,000 next year. That makes it the second least expensive school of the top 50 liberal arts colleges in the country. So the thing to realize, though, is that schools like the University of Pennsylvania, with over $20,000 just in tuition and close to $30,000 total cost, only 7% of the students in America are in schools that expensive. And the other 93% are in a whole range of institutions. St. Olaf is one of those in the couple tiers down from that highest. But why is higher education so expensive, and how did it get there? And it probably everyone here knows that the cost of higher education has been going faster than consumer price index for quite a few years. In fact, in the 80s and early 90s, at St. Olaf, tuition went up on average 9% a year. There were some very big jumps early in the 80s as they were trying to make up for the inflation of the 70s. And then lower ones later, but 9% overall. Now, St. Olaf and most of higher education, the increases are somewhere between 3 and 5%. Consumer price index, this last year, is about 2.8%. Why is it? What is driving the costs? Let me tell you a bit about what I picked out as some of the major drivers, and then we can talk about whether it's worth it. I've identified here five things that are driving price or costs, and the by far the most important is financial aid, and that might seem paradoxical, but the amount of financial aid that schools are given for students has been going up much, much faster than their tuition over the last several years. At St. Olaf, now a fifth of our budget is spent on financial aid out of our own resources. That's not counting what government give and so on. So a fifth of our overall budget is financial aid. Why is that happening? Largely because three-fifths of Americans in the last 15 years have lost ground economically in real terms. And one-fifth has just maintained sort of an even keel, and only the top fifth has done well since 1977. So that means that the middle class, and I really mean the middle class, has less disposable income when you adjust for inflation. And so students need more financial aid. I told you that at St. Olaf, the cost, if you paid full freight, would be a little over $20,000 next year. The average student, though, will spend around $11,000, the student and the family. And the rest is being covered by financial aid, much of it coming from the institution itself. So one of the reasons tuition is going up is there's cost shifting going on. That is, the people who can pay are subsidizing kids who can't. This is highly frowned upon in the medical profession, and there's been a lot of things recently about saying that's wrong. I think there's a much stronger justification for it in higher education, because in medicine, if you have you have a hysterectomy and the person next to you has a hysterectomy, you're not benefited at all by the fact that the one next to you has it. Has had one too. Right? I could have used different examples. Half the audience didn't even care. The point is that that you don't gain much by the fact that another person gets the same medical treatment, except perhaps the surgeon will have more practice. But in education, probably half of what you learn, at least in a residential college, you learn from your fellow students. An extraordinarily important part of an undergraduate education is learning with others and living with others. And that we have felt in the higher education community, it's very important that our population be as diverse as we can make it, which means economically diverse as well as ethnically or racially or religiously diverse. And so part of the reason tuitions have been driven is because a lot of folks can't pay, and so those who can pay have been footing some of the bill for those who can't. However, at most places, private colleges at least, even those who are paying full freight are not paying for the full cost of the education. At St. Olaf, roughly two-thirds of the or one-third of the cost of educating each student is borne by gifts, either past gifts or present gifts or investment in physical plant and libraries and facilities and so on like that. So even a person who's paying their full tuition is still being subsidized. But within that, those who are paying full are helping out those who can't afford it. So that's probably the biggest driver for why costs have been going up. But you have to tie the financial aid with something else that's been happening. Government support, when adjusted for inflation, is about at the same point it was before Sputnik. What happened was there was a tremendous, with Sputnik, there was a tremendous increase in federal funds, and also there was a building boom as the baby boom went through. Colleges and universities grew very rapidly. A lot of government money and support went in. But in recent years, it's remained static in nominal terms, and when adjusted for inflation, has been going down. The tax package that's being debated right now will be the first real increase in many years for financial aid. That would be loans and outright grants for the lower middle and lower class economically. So what's happened is there's been a cost shifting going on there, where the government has shifted costs to the institutions. And the institutions, though, therefore, have had to raise money where they could, and they've raised it from those who could pay more. There's a second part in which government has played a large role, and that is regulation. The number of people at St. Olaf College who are largely involved in following government regulation has grown dramatically over the last 20 or 30 years, all for good reasons, no doubt. But for example, because of some problems with federal grant funding at some of the big research universities, we now have to audit our federal grants every year. And we have someone who, during part of the year, that's all they're doing, is handling that. And we don't have very many, because we have some in our sciences and the like, but that's a requirement. There are a whole range of OSHA, the Americans with Disability Act, a whole range of things that for very good reasons have been put in place but cost us a huge amount of money. Making every building on an old, beautiful campus like St. Olaf handicap accessible at every floor cost a fortune. So that the accounting, the regulations of various sorts have driven costs as well. And we have a fair number of folks now, either that we employ or that we hire, who are doing things because we are required to. All of these requirements perhaps could be, some of them are not as sensible as others. Many of them, though, are well-meaning and are important, but they do have financial consequences which drive the cost. The third area that I would point out, I have it, the word here is faculty, but really what it is that when you look at the cost of higher education and compare it to the consumer price index, you assume you're delivering the same product. You know, if someone is making widgets and there's an inflation, the widgets, you know, should not be going faster than the rate of inflation. But what we're doing is delivering, in these terms, we are educating, we're delivering knowledge, but we're educating people. And the amount of knowledge that our faculty has to deal with is growing a lot faster than the consumer price index. Let me give you a pretty dramatic example. About 15 years ago, Chemistry Abstracts, which is a series that gives brief summaries of articles published in chemistry, would have about 250,000 entries. A couple years ago, Chemistry Abstracts had 1.25 million entries in a year. Don't hold me to the exact numbers, but it's about, that's the sort of ratio. What does that mean? That means there are five times more articles being published in chemistry. So to cover that, one human being can't read that many articles, or even if it, so you end up with more faculty to cover the waterfront, even at an undergraduate level. And then at the same time, we've developed all these new programs in the interstices between normal departments or regular departments. We have things like urban studies.
Oh, come on, give us a break.
There's a director of urban studies for the ACM upstairs. Urban studies, Hispanic studies, women's studies, environmental studies, a whole range of new areas. They haven't been made into departments. They're often interdisciplinary, but they take more people. So at St. Olaf, from the period 1985 to 1994, the number of tenured faculty grew by 50%. Those are the faculty you can't fire. Tenured faculty. And they all have to be paid. And the article in Time magazine would let you make you think that they were all being paid, you know, like princes. You know, they were talking about $110,000 and what have you. At St. Olaf, people who have PhDs and spend well over 40 hours a week reading, teaching, meeting with students, doing committee work, and so on, are being paid on average about $43,000. That's not a bad income. But if you think if they were in law or medicine or a variety of other things that require the intelligence and training of a PhD, they'd be doing better than that. They're doing it because they really believe in educating young people. But we've got to pay them. About two-thirds of the cost of our budget is involved in salaries, and much of that faculty salaries, and they're not being overpaid. There's only a handful of research universities and professional schools where the individuals command these princely salaries, and most of the teaching is done by graduate students. At the great majority of places, the teaching is done by the professors, and they do it very well. They care a lot about their students, and they're not particularly well paid in the process. Another thing that's happened is the cost of staff has gone up because we're providing many more services than we ever did before. Right now, there's counseling service for psychological problems, there's medical support, there's academic counseling, you know, with reading and math and other issues that might be, there's chemical and dependency There's a whole range of things. And one of the sad facts about modern society is that our kids coming to college are coming with more problems, more overt problems, than was true in the past. A very high percentage of the students at St. Olaf, approaching 50%, come from single-parent or blended families, single-parent-headed or blended families. That was not true even a few years ago. And whatever one has to say about the reasons for divorce and remarriage and the like, there's no doubt that it's hard on kids. It may be better than the alternative, but it's still not easy. And so a significant number of our students come with psychological challenges and end up getting free counseling. Of the folks that saw the counseling center last year, there were about 600 visits. About 100 of those were on pretty heavy-duty medications for psychological problems. So that there's just, it's a more complicated world. And the support services are needed, and they are expected. We also have career placement and a variety of other things. So there's a very significant infrastructure that is supporting students when they go on. And then finally, there's facilities. And that would include equipment and the like. Let's take that first. Computers. Computers, you can get more and more power for the same amount of money. And that's something where you'd say, well, boy, the power for, you know, per MIP or whatever, it's getting cheaper and cheaper. The trouble is that you buy it and it becomes obsolete practically before you get it out of the box. And that at a university or a college, you need the latest equipment. So basically, we are spending $2 million a year on computer support of one form or another on a $60 million budget. Same is true with laboratory equipment. Library books. That same chemistry abstracts has gone up many times the rate of inflation over the last 15 years. I think it costs like $17,000 a year now for chemistry abstracts. We don't get it anymore at St. Olaf. It's too expensive. And that with all this proliferation of knowledge, we are spending more money on the library to get not only books or journals, but also electronic media and the like. So that's another thing driving it. And finally, the facilities generally. When I went to college, and when many of you went to college, you were in a dormitory, right, with a long hall, bathrooms at the end of the hall, or maybe in the middle if you were lucky, two to a room, right?
Four,
yes. Now, many students expect, and colleges are beginning to deliver, what are called pods, or suites, where each student has his or her own room around a central area and share a bathroom. It's like a luxury hotel, almost. That costs more money. So you add all these things up, and these are the major factors of why prices have been going up so rapidly. It's not gouging. The argument that why are they gouging you? I mean, talk about yellow journalism. There's a real problem, though, because as I said, most people are putting more and more of their year's income into education when they have kids as a percentage of their family income. We are heading towards a crisis because it is clear that a college degree, whatever it's worth, is worth a whole lot more than just a high school degree. So if we look just in economic terms, now we're moving to the worst side, it's not so much that that a college degree has been getting that much better in terms of your lifetime's earning. It's that people only with a high school degree, their earnings have fallen through the floor. So that the middle class, the broad American population knows that you've got to get a college degree, or you're just going to, you know, you're going to end up flipping hamburgers for your whole life, whatever you might do for a few years out of college. And when you know that you've got to have it, then the issue of price becomes very important, because they say, well, I can't afford it, and so I'm being denied the opportunity to, you know, to buy, you have a part of the American dream, and people get anxious, and that's why we have all the discussion right now. One study on the return on education at one of the Ivies versus if you took the money that you spent to go to college over 4 years and instead invested that money minus certain living expenses in a mutual fund and projected it out and compared the two, which is the better investment? Well, the average return over a lifetime, and this is in the past, there's no guarantee that it would be in the future, but the trends would indicate is about 14%. You're not going to get a mutual fund that will give you 14% over the long haul. And that's just in monetary terms. We're not even beginning to discuss the other quality of life issues involved and the importance of citizenship that's involved in an education. That's at the more expensive schools. If you go to a the University of Minnesota or the University of Washington, what is the tuition at the University of Washington?
It's pretty high.
It's pretty high. Okay. Well,
tuition or reward is $12,000. If you're out of state, it's $17,000.
Okay, 12 and 17. Thank you. That's a year. That would be tuition, room, and board,
yeah.
All three? Okay. Compared to 20 at St. Olaf. What other schools?
8 at LBI.
8?
Yeah.
Okay. At Lutheran Bible Institute? And PLU?
I think that was about 23 then.
23? That's about, coastal are more expensive than the Midwest, as a general rule. What?
27 at Stanford.
27 at Stanford. And when I went, my first year it was 2000. Over here. All right, is it? Let me stop now and let's start talking. First, are there any questions about what I presented? Well, let's start sharing stories. Is it worth it?
Mark, do you have a sense of the financial role of people who go to trade schools to learn a skill, learn a trade, go to cooking school, or carpenter school or something?
Yeah, you mean
where do they fall? You said high school diploma goes through the toilet, through the ground.
Right. I don't have a percentage on it. It certainly, any training is better than none.
Yeah.
With a few exceptions. The problem is if you look at someone who goes through a vocational program, not in the Lutheran sense, but in the secular sense, or goes to college and does a very vocational degree, like accounting or computer science, or on the more applied sort, they will normally start out with a higher income initially than a college graduate in a liberal arts. But what happens is, if you drew their incomes, they'll start out like this and then they'll sort of flatten off.
Yeah.
The liberal arts grad will go like that and go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They did a survey, Yankelevich, the survey research firm in New York, did a survey.
You just spoke to a PhD professor at your university making 43 a year, and a tradesman at Boeing, having gone through a two-year community college program or trade school, is making far in excess of that money.
Yep.
So I take exception, I guess, to your last statement. I don't understand the curve.
The curve is wrong.
Well, the couple things. Remember, there aren't that many professors compared to all the liberal arts grads.
I would assume the scales for a PhD versus, say, just a BA would be significantly different.
Not necessarily. If you have a professional degree, you get an MBA, that'll have effect. A law degree, a PhD, it varies. If you're in economics, you can make a lot more. If you're in Latin classics, there's not much market demand beyond teaching. And that was an average.
Right.
The economists are paid more. The average economist at St. Olaf is probably 10 or 12,000 above that.
plus what number of trade school graduates make the Boeing salary? And what percentage? I think it's a small, I don't think it's a great percentage. Boeing, in Duluth, there aren't a lot that would make that Boeing salary.
I think that the highly skilled folks, yeah, can do very well.
Mark?
Yeah.
There would also be another aspect, and that is that some would choose for a sense of call to be involved in a lower salary. And I would assume some of your professors would be that, clergy, people-related occupations, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
So that would also tend to lower the number, but good reason, and there would be another value attached to that, hopefully.
Mm-hmm.
What's the study you're quoting?
Which one? This?
On the 14%.
Now, I've read various ones, and I'm not sure which one I am quoting. I think that's the one that was done by the American Council on Education, the ACE study, but it could be the College Board study. The study I was about to mention by Yankelevich, which was done by Hope for Hobart William Smith, surveyed different segments of the population about the value of liberal arts education, and the ones that ranked it the highest were CEOs of companies, and talked about the hiring in that area. I think that, I mean, the objection there is a valid one. When we're dealing with averages, we're dealing with, none of us, we are not the mean. None of us is the average. And there's a fair amount of variation around the average. But one of the things that's happening in our society, and it's been happening more recently, is that the really well-paying industrial positions are disappearing, relatively speaking. Boeing is bucking a more general trend where, so that the, that's part of the reason why three-fifths of the American population has been losing ground in real terms. Because of some of the changes in the economy overall.
In our community, we've noticed in 10 years that the average incomes have gone down because of the tech jobs coming in paying lower. Yeah, because they can, so we have more employees,
mm-hmm.
but they pay less, so it drags down everybody. But about the college stuff, I've heard the premise that students are terrible consumers. The less you give them, the more they like it. So they're not challenged. And then I hear of students being passed on. And is that affecting the investment that's being made? Because if students are getting into college now with lower standards, is that going to affect the investments that parents make?
I think it, I don't know. I'd have to think that one through. We have more remedial classes than we used to bring people up. We have special programs and assistance that we didn't have before. And I know some employers complain that when they graduate, they have to be re-educated or they haven't gotten the training. It certainly raised the cost of college education because college is often doing high school remedial work before it starts doing the college.
Have any comparisons been done with overseas colleges as regards the increasing costs? Are costs increasing overseas at the same rate?
Yes, there have been some. As a general rule, the pressures driving the cost of education, many of them are driving them also overseas. But America is the only one with such a mixed system, or one of the few. And overseas, most of them are state institutions, and the way they handle costs there is they ration access quite a bit more. But the cost of going to an English university has gone through the roof as well recently.
Mark, surely in a place like Holden Village, we can't have this conversation without considering what do we mean by a return on investment.
That's why I asked for worth beyond, I said, if starting just because we started with dollars, there's a lot more involved in that.
Satisfaction of quality of life, satisfaction, do you love going to work? Do you do work that you think makes a contribution on the planet that's meaningful, that uses your skills well, that challenges you? Does your work give you lots of vacations or enough vacation? Does your work give you time to spend with your family? All of those kinds of things that you can presumably buy with whatever kind of education you get to do whatever work you do. Enter into the equation.
Mm-hmm. A lot of going to college is learning about something that you want to do for work, so that, because you generally want to work on something that you'll be doing for the rest of your life, so it's something you want to do. Mm-hmm. And so that's something else that when you go to college, that's something you want to do, is mm-hmm. you want to learn something that you want to do for the rest of your life.
Yeah, and I would say
that would go back to your 14% yeah. investment.
When you ask what you're being educated for, this same survey by Yankelevich, even more parents than students gave as their number one reason was to get a job. Which is interesting. And of course, an education should allow a person to be qualified for a job or jobs. A liberal arts education tends to prepare you best for the second job that you have. That is, the first time you make a major change in what you're doing. And that's where, in fact, learning how to learn, being flexible, being able to acquire information quickly, having the literacy, both numeric and written, and being able to express yourself well becomes important.
But what he said is an excellent point, because an education is not something you consume. It's not something you go out and buy. It's something that you use as a tool to live in a way you want to live.
Right.
And yeah. So it doesn't matter what you pay for it. It's beside the point. I think the question of that article raised is that it implied that the money was being wasted, or that you were being gouged, and that's what raised everybody's hackles. I don't think the expense of education has anything to do with what the decision of getting an education.
But the expense does. You can't afford it. Franz that's says true. We're going. Our tuition is going up greater than CPI. And if that continues, at some point, it'll become unaffordable.
You just afford those to a very.
Well, I mean, that's where I was at. I mean, I was able to send one daughter to PLU for 2 years, and then she had to go to a state college. I mean, that was my finances,
Right.
I had two kids to school, you need to pay. This is how much it's going to cost, and this is what I can afford. The state institution, as far as I'm concerned, offers as educational opportunity is just as good as PLU was. PLU offers some fringes on the side that you don't get at state institutions, as far as the place you want to send your kid and the quality of education, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but at some point it becomes unaffordable, and you can say, "Gee whiz, I don't care what it costs. If you can't pay it, it doesn't matter."
But you can go into debt when you buy a house. Why can't you go into debt when you get an education?
Certain of us who have made lifestyle choices that fit this conversation and all. Hark back to what this man over here said before. I happen to be a person who chose, I went to St. Olaf, and I chose to live in a very poor area economically for many reasons. And I really value my time spent at St. Olaf. I have two young daughters, you've probably seen them around 6 and 9. If we stay where we are, there's no way that I can send them to what I have.
I'd like to challenge that, at least. What the dilemma that I as a president face and these institutions face is to continue doing what we're doing now, which is to try to make sure that your daughters can go. I mean, we have a significant number of students that are getting full rides, that they're getting tuition, room, and board. They may be doing work study as part of it. There may be some loans involved, but all of their expenses are being covered. And in fact, as a general rule, if a student is reasonably bright, they're better off applying to a private school. They'll get more financial aid than at the public.
Yeah.
That's the sticker shock problem, is that you look at that price, you say, I can't possibly afford that. Now, but that's not what most people pay. It is still the case, though, that higher education is becoming more expensive and that people legitimately are worried about access. And we're worried about it, too. That's where some of, I mean, that's where, for example, especially government, there's been a big shift in ideology among certain segments of the population, the political. And the shift goes like this. In the past, Americans saw education as a public good. You invest in education because it's good for the society. It makes good citizens. It develops the economy. There is now an ideology that is pretty strong on the Hill that says education is a private good. That education, because of this 14% return, and it is that, well, given that sort of return, people should invest in it. And if they're too stupid to invest in it, you know, borrow because they'll have that sort of return, that's their lookout. And that's a huge political change. And a very distressing one.
Two points or questions. One, I recall about 20 years ago, a study in Minnesota that indicated that St. Olaf College for its education cost less than Mankato State University. The question was, who paid for what? But in terms of the total cost, obviously it was government. It cost less for parent or student, but the total cost was more at Mankato State than St. Olaf Gustavus. I'm wondering if there's an update on that. And second, one of the things that I'm hearing is that more and more of the state, of the students going to state colleges take longer to get through their studies than they do, generally speaking, at private institutions. Could you speak to those two?
Briefly, although that sort of takes us off the question overall of the cost, I would say it costs more to educate someone at St. Olaf than at Mankato because we have a much lower student-faculty ratio. That is, we have far more faculty for the size of the student body, and we provide more services. And we may pay our people a little less than they do at Mankato because Mankato State is unionized, I think. In the Wash, I think it costs more.
Okay.
In terms of graduation, 75% of our students graduate in 4 years and 85% in five, and we don't count after that because the remaining 15% normally have transferred somewhere else. There's very few that take six years. The average at the University of Minnesota is 11% in 4 years. So if you figure out, but that's a complicated statistic because a lot of folks are working, so they're going to school part-time.
That's true, too.
But as a general rule, if a private education, you'll get through more quickly. And if you factor in being able to go into the workforce earlier, it does make a difference.
Can you address the issue of private school versus state schools in vying for the top students? Or the state schools, I know that the private schools have to offer a package like what you're talking about, and actually presenting it in a much more professional way than we have. Well, I'm talking, my background is Valparaiso University, and we have really changed a lot in our PR, in our approach to recruiting students and so forth, because the population everybody's vying for the same population. Before, if you were a Lutheran, you would go to a Lutheran institution. That was kind of a given. Because we have grown so broad in taking in a lot of students, I think a little over 50% at Valpo is Lutheran. I think it's up to 55 as a requirement. And after that, and before, when I went there many, many years ago, it was far higher than that. But anyway, we're all buying for the same student, and the population pool has gone down. Mm-hmm. And so can you address how St. Olaf's is addressing that problem in competing with, and it is a competitive market out there for college students?
Yeah. Well, first, I mean, many more people are going to college than ever did before. I'm in it.
I'm talking about top students.
Right. I understand. I'm just going to give a little background.
Okay.
That a very large percentage of the population now at least does some college. And that was not true 50 years ago. I mean, the second thing is that right after World War II, I don't know the exact percentage, but over half the students went to private institutions. Now well over two-thirds go to public. Liberal arts colleges or small universities like Valpo make up maybe 7 or 8% of all. So most still go to public institutions. Yes, there is competition for the brightest students. Although as a general rule, if you're a good basketball player, there's a lot more competition for you than if you're a good student. Or football or volleyball. Title IX has had some effect here. And there is, a few years ago there was a ruling that that said that the Ivy League could no longer compare the amounts of money that they were offering students. And so that was seen as anti-competitive. The argument the Ivy Leagues was that people should make their decision up not on the basis of how much money they got in financial aid, but on which school was best for them. Well, they lost that argument. And so there is sometimes competition and bidding that goes back and forth for particularly good students. Once again, the reason is you want diversity, which includes also you want some really bright kids or some really great musicians or some great athletes or people who are really excellent in the theater. And you want minorities and the like because you want a diverse, and you end up bidding against each other. And that you also fight with the publics on that. Last year we lost two students that were African American that we wanted to the University of Minnesota, who offered them a full ride plus $4,000 in pocket money. And this is a state institution. And so at the one hand you have people who can't afford it, and then the other...
What's the percentage of St. Olaf students that are on financial aid?
Over 70%.
Well, I come from upstate on Rock Island. 95% of our students have financial aid.
You charge more, too.
I think we're about the same.
Oh, a little more.
I don't think so.
Okay. Gertrude is undoubtedly right. Yeah, it's 75% across the river at Carleton. It's 85%.
All right. Do you see any private colleges doing what state colleges are doing, where you can buy your child's education now, even though they're not gone for 10 or 15 years?
Yeah, that working with Lutheran Brotherhood, the Lutheran colleges will announce probably in the fall a thing where you can buy units. And when you bought 1 year's worth of tuition at current prices, you're guaranteed 1 year of tuition 18 years down or whenever the kid goes to school.
Well, why couldn't they do that 17 years ago when I was
Mark, what's that going to do to your rising cost if your rising costs are going faster than the return on that money in the market?
But then
your costs are going to rise more.
Well, no. What we're doing. Since in the 3 years I've been at St. Olaf, we've taken more than $1 million out of the budget each year, and we are trying very hard to buck these trends and move it back to as close to the CPI as we can get it. And that's meant trying to learn to do things more efficiently, sharing. Positions, we have a number of positions we share with Carleton. We're not going to teach some things that we taught before. I mean, one of the drivers was we're teaching a lot more different subjects. We're learning from business while not compromising or trying not to compromise the quality of academic offerings to try to make it, you know, control the costs.
Commenting to something that was said earlier about going to college so you can work, in some ways that is true because you almost need a college education to do anything but flip burgers at McDonald's and ask, can you have fries with that?
Mm-hmm.
And you really need to go to college in order to get any sort of decent job. And so I think that, you know, we do need to be going to college, and it's getting pretty expensive to do that. And they're enforcing us, they really want us to have our education. But if we keep on raising the prices, as was said before, we're not gonna be able to. By the time I go to college, which is a year, maybe two, the price could raise by like $4,000 or $5,000.
Well, no, not probably that much, but it could go up 5% a year.
And, you know, by that point, it's getting pretty darn expensive. And frankly, I know my mom can't pay that much to go to college. And, you know, there is financial aid and, you know, you get your scholarships and stuff like that. It was one reason why I'm a musician, is maybe get a scholarship for that. But you can't always get scholarships, and it's getting more and more expensive. And the competition for those scholarships alone is getting greater.
Yeah, there are merit scholarships that are not based on financial aid tend to be quite competitive and more competitive. The point that that Ingrid made earlier is that the worth of a college education goes well beyond an income and a job. But if there's not a job, all these other things...
It falls through.
So having said that, I think that the challenge that our society faces is making sure that education does remain affordable. And that, I mean, I talked about the 9% increase in price over a 15-year period on average, which is now going to quit. But if you look at public education, the increase in cost in public education has been going even faster than that in recent years. So that many public institutions are approaching the cost of a private institution. And that's a dangerous situation. The genius of American education is its variety. You have different public institutions, and you have a different private, you have a mix. And you have a large number of junior colleges, you have vocational and technical schools, you have a whole range of programs that will deal with the different interests and abilities and desires of the population. But if everything gets too expensive, we're in trouble. And that's why I think politics is part of this. We in the private sector have to show that we've got our costs under control. And we have to show that what we're delivering is something that is valued, not just in economic terms, but it has to be valued in economic terms. Not just in, but it has to be. Then you folks, the folks who are sending, either going to school or sending your kids to school, have to make some decisions about what you want out of it. Do you want to go to a school that offers every department? The University of Massachusetts has recently announced that only, I think, two of its campuses are going to offer physics as a department because there aren't sufficient number of students. So if you want to do physics, you have to go to that. Is everyone going to insist on having the suite for housing? We figured out the cost of a daily cost at St. Olaf right now. This would be a year ago. You pay $81 a day, which gives you room and board, instruction in four courses, and with individual counseling inside and out, psychological counseling, academic counseling, athletic facilities, music, dance, and theater performances that are free for $81 a day. We're actually doing pretty good at $81 a day. The trouble is that the American population, most of us can't afford $81 a day for our kids. And that's where the government, we have to do our part of it in restraining costs, but we need help. The society has to realize it's a public good and it has to put money into it. And I think that's where Clinton and the Republicans although in different ways they're starting to respond to that.
That's true, but it also seems like people are very willing to take $30,000 to buy a new pickup, and they won't take out loans for children to go to school, and that's very frustrating. I teach high school in a lower economic town. It's very frustrating. The mindset there is that these aren't worth it. As for trade schools, I think you hear stories or you hear data about people change their jobs 4 or 5 times during their career. If you go to a trade school, that means you have to go 4 or 5 times to get retrained each time. And that's not true with a liberal arts degree. It seems that for some reason there must be more education, or there's a need to educate people on the value of these types of the liberal arts program as against all of these practical job-only things that train you into dead-end situations.
But to that, and I'm hearing criticism about parents not taking out enough loans, but I know if you're a conscientious objector, you won't register, you can't get any federal loans, right? So you cut out of that. And if I'm a parent and I have just certain assets, I can borrow up to the maximum of that. But I don't think I can go down to the bank and say, I want to borrow on my son's education because he's my son. There's a limit. Yeah. When I buy a pickup, I got a tangible object, but I don't have a tangible object in my son's mind. Are you aware of loan programs like that? Because I hear that, but I was like, I'm not aware of that.
The key goes to school in Massachusetts. The state of Massachusetts will loan you as much money as it requires to send them to school there.
I got to move to Massachusetts. What about the state of Washington?
You don't have to move to Massachusetts. Just have your kids in school there.
But I think you raise a very good point. When you buy a house, you don't pay that off in 4 years. And that there is an asset there. And the collateral. One of the proposals that's out there is being able to borrow the money and pay it back depending on what your income is. So that it's those people who have a higher income will pay back, will pay more, and those with lower. One of the things, the current situation is skews career choices. So we have a lot of people choosing things because they have large student loans, and they're not willing to come and volunteer at Holden or do something like that.
But now with the student loans, I'm an attorney in this state, and I know that this state has responded to the federal mandate that says if you are in default of student loans, you will lose your license, your professional license, be your doctor, lawyer, anything else. This is the same situation we're doing child support. So we didn't talk about this, but we're going to start to see men and women, because the federal mandate came down, we just passed it in our state, and it's going to hit the other states. So if you're in default of your student loans, because you get out, you don't get the job in 5 months, you don't have a license. You can't earn your living. So you get whipped by the system.
That sounds really bad.
But that's what it is now, because I had to participate in that legislation.
Okay. Well, but we are, the government is supposed to respond to us, the citizenry. That sounds like a mess.
In my poor area, we live in northern Idaho, and we have to vote every year to maintain the buildings that we already have. And it's the climate of our area, the political climate. The voice of the citizen is, we'll take care of ourselves, thank you very kindly. And I don't know when that's going to turn around, but up where we are now, we had a gym fall in with all the heavy snow, and a lot of, no one was killed, no one was in it at the time that they could have. So I think, the consequences are starting with, I think people start to, I'm hoping people see what they're doing finally, the consequences are coming down.
Well, I mean, this is a case where, this goes from K through 12 and college, is that we're not willing, we as a society, we have changed some of our values of where we're going to put public monies. And you've heard it's almost a cliche how much it costs to incarcerate someone versus educate them. But we're spending money. In Minnesota, the percentage of the state budget that goes to education is falling below what they spend on prisons and health care. It's going to, over time, it's going to keep ratcheting down the list.
Prisons are a growth industry.
Yeah, prisons are a growth industry. it's, we, oh, excuse me.
I have two questions. Going back to the overall educational expenses, does St. Olaf have a foreign exchange campus someplace in Europe? Do you exchange students? And if so, or if not, yes or no? And then if, can you tell us how that affects the expense of running the university? Do these programs have to pay for themselves before they're maintained? Or how is that handled?
We don't have the statistics this year, but the year before last, we sent more students abroad than any other college in the country, all over the world. We don't have our own campuses. We have some cases our own programs, and in many cases they go and study at universities elsewhere. We try to run those programs as revenue neutral. We take all, there's a formula we work with. We try to, we don't make money on it, but we try not to lose money on it. And we have scholarships to cover it. And it's very important because we have housing for 26,000 students and we have 28,050 students. And that, the only way we handle that is that 200 students are gone all the time. We were number one in sending students abroad. Carleton was number two, and I couldn't help but think it had something to do with the weather in Northfield. let me say that St. Olaf and most of the Lutheran institutions and most private institutions like Whitman and PLU and the like try to meet all demonstrated need. We do at this point. I don't know with your situation, it didn't sound, I mean, and I'm not a financial aid officer, but the institutions, the Lutheran institutions especially, were founded by immigrants in most cases who wanted their children to get a job, to become good citizens, and supporters in their church. They were designed to be accessible and affordable. In many cases, they were co-educational right from the beginning. And most of them still are committed to that. So in your case, your daughters may have to work part-time. We're trying to limit it to 10 hours a week. They will certainly have to take out loans. But we will do everything. And these other schools, you know, Lutheran, Gustavus, and Cal Lutheran and so on, will try to make sure that you can study there. It is getting harder. It is getting a lot harder, yes.
There's another part to this equation is that the parents don't send the kids to school, the kids send themselves to school, and they have to do their share of the work right from the beginning, because then they can get the scholarship if they work at it.
That's true.
But I just have been wanting to say that that then, you know, I agree with the kids having to earn it, but then they come out of school with these student loans. And I don't know how it is for anybody else, but for us it was, our daughter went to Concordia at Moorhead. Then she went on to Luther Seminary, and she came, we helped her as much as we could. She got financial aid, she got student loans. And our church helped with tuition for the seminary, but she still came out of 8 years of school owing $12,000, which isn't bad, I guess, for but here's the thing. So she's a pastor. She goes into her first parish. She has to start paying back these student loans, and she's living below poverty wages.
Yeah.
You know,
but there are no real struggles.
But she can hardly had money to buy herself food. You know, by the time she was paying back the loans and the thing, and so there is a burden on that end too.
One of the things that happened in the federal program is not only is the dollar amount declined in real terms, it's shifted largely from grants to loans.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
There's been a big shift. And then in the beyond that, to cover it, schools have had to ask the students to take on additional loans beyond that to cover. I think the issue of loans and what they do is a very serious one, because I think it distorts career choice in ways. Most people can get out of even the most expensive undergraduate with a relatively small loan burden. But if you go on to graduate school, you're in real, you can end up with a lot of, a real lot of loan. And that's why schools and partners like Lutheran Brotherhood are trying to figure out, are there other ways of financing it? We're, for example, trying to figure out ways that we can increase works, work study, so that even people who don't qualify can still work to help costs. They're looking at ways of paying back so that you, if you take out money, it can be paid back, and that if you go into certain professions, it'll be forgiven. You know, if you go into low-paying professions that the society needs. And we just have to be creative in thinking it through. I've gone beyond my time. We've just barely began the topic, but I have a plea to you, and that is that that you let your representatives, state and national, know how important this issue is to you, and that you do that for the K through 12, too, because our future depends on education. And if we don't solve this problem, we could become, you know, I won't even think about what we could become. Especially because our kids are the ones that are going to pay our Social Security when we retire. So think of it as an investment in our own future. Thanks a lot for coming.